Today, I am setting out to answer a question that so often goes unanswered when it comes to book buying, which is, why are first editions so valuable? For those library enthusiasts out there, it might be time to put away that library card for just a moment or two while we dive into the specifics of hardcore book buying. Hello, and welcome back to Diddy and Hawthorne in the In-Between. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to my podcast about the relevancy of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book, and let's begin. First of all, if you're really that into libraries, check out episode 5 on the Dewey Decimal System to help you get around. But I want to clarify the definition of a first edition. A first edition is a book printed within the first physical printing of that book, also within the first finalized version of it. More narrowly, this means that the book must be a physical copy, so it can't be an audiobook or an ebook, and it must be one of the first ever printed of that book, period. If you have a first edition, it might also not be within the first printing of that book, so it's important to know what printing batch the book came in to determine things like authenticity and value. So for book collectors, the reason that makes the most sense to me as to why first editions are so sought after comes from a quote that I found on Quill and Brush, which is a rare book collection site. They say that, quote, "It's the edition the author actually saw through to production and the closest in time to the writing, and therefore the edition most likely to represent the author's intent," end quote. We've touched on this part a bit, even with the December Dickens reading. The edition that you get determines in part the experience that you get from reading that book. So if you have the so-called author's edition, then you might have an experience closer to the author's desired work, uninhibited by things like ex post facto editing or translation, etc. These factors get to be an even bigger deal when talking about authors like James Joyce, who, in experimenting, were never quite done with writing and thus came out with hand-tailored edition after edition, trying to get things right. Then, certain editions, like perhaps the 5th edition from a Dublin publishing company specifically, became really popular in addition to the first editions. Another reason why first editions are usually so rare is because publishers often print a small number of books first to see how they sell before printing more. Intuitively, this makes sense, right? Why print 100,000 copies of a book when you're not sure of your investment yourself? Okay, that may perhaps be harsh, but you know what I mean. Famous authors almost always have humble beginnings, making their first edition books very rare and in turn very valuable later on. A good example of this, and one that I wanted to throw into this episode in general because I think it's so fun, is First Editions by the author Cormac McCarthy. The name may sound familiar from books like The Road and All the Pretty Horses. McCarthy is a contemporary regionalist writer, most famously writing about the Texas-Mexico border region, as well as the Tennessee area, if I'm not mistaken. His books are notoriously dark and have the telltale McCarthyisms, like a lack of quotation marks around dialogue or untranslated sections of text in the middle of a passage. If I had to put some words into his prose style or describing it in general, I'd say that it's realist to the point of exacerbation. One of the points that his books are often described under is the ratio of dialogue to description, like, one book has half dialogue and half description. The first time I heard that, though I was a bit flabbergasted at such an oversimplification of a great writer, I definitely chuckled to myself at how much sense it made. McCarthy, in other words, is a pretty big deal, and he's famous in his personal life for being a recluse. This means that, yep, you guessed it, the chance of getting your hands on signed copies of his books are slim to none. Out of a sort of morbid curiosity, I looked up what a signed copy of All the Pretty Horses goes for, and in addition to finding out that there's actually a Cormac McCarthy Society dedicated to these kinds of questions, a signed copy of All the Pretty Horses goes for about $1,500, though the copy that I found was A, was not a true first edition, and B, was actually the first British version published months after and across the world from the originals. One of the people on the Cormac McCarthy Society jokingly mentioned that though a first edition of The Road or All the Pretty Horses isn't that rare, if you find a signed copy, it's definitely a forgery. Weird, huh? Next, I want to delve into one of my favorite reasons why first editions are so valuable, the story. There's a fantastic article by Time Magazine about the first edition of The Great Gatsby, which I will link in the description for you, but the story that I want to tell for this is as follows, and you might have heard this before on this channel, but that is okay, I love this story. The Great Gatsby, when it first came out, was not popular at all. Flat out not popular. Fitzgerald claimed and always knew that the book was his masterpiece, but others saw it differently and kind of made him out to be a one-hit wonder, citing his brilliant book, This Side of Paradise, which I highly recommend, by the way, was pretty much his effective start and end as a writer. But he was such a big hit that the publisher, after the first edition, printed thousands upon thousands of copies, expecting them to sell, which they absolutely did not. America, by the way, was at war, and the book came out at the exact wrong time to be a bestseller. I mean, talk about bad timing. It wasn't about war, first of all. It wasn't about America's triumph, second of all, and it certainly did not cater to the sentiment at that moment of time, as a third reason. It is actually still true today that people historically are willing to spend more money and time on books per average than other sources of entertainment. So if you think about it, the average novel is about 315 pages, which takes the average person 7 hours to read and $15 to buy. That's much less than, say, a movie, which is 2 hours long at the long end and is $10 for a ticket. And if you take in the opportunity cost of that thing, which is the time that takes you to go buy the book, physically buy it in dollars, and then read it in time, that is vastly, vastly more than, say, a movie. So, The Great Gatsby wasn't a hit. What the publisher ended up doing, though, was send all of the books to the American soldiers abroad fighting in the war, who, after the war ended, which was after Fitzgerald's death, by the way, came home and said, "You have to read this incredible book, it's so amazing." Some, so it's said, were actually under the impression that the book was so popular that it was being sent to soldiers as a kind of, quote, what people are reading back home at the moment, which I think added to the spike of popularity after the war, along with the aforementioned reasons being reversed, of course. This backstory clearly makes the first edition of the book very popular, and very popular it is indeed. There are said to be only 5 copies left of the book with the original dust jacket untouched, and one of them sold a few years ago at around $180,000. Now on to another big question. How can you tell if you have a first edition? For older books, like those published before and around 1900, there are often famous aspects about it called points that are used to differentiate them from later editions, and these are much easier to spot because the technology for forgery wasn't that great then, and it's easier to tell what those mistakes are just based on the way they made books back then. These aspects, and I'm quoting from Quill and Brush again, the text, the type used, the number of pages, the dates in the ads, or the type of binding. So oftentimes, especially later, however, so modern day first editions will often have typographical errors, aka typos, and they're used to differentiate those editions from the latter editions. Something small, like a difference in end pages, can be the difference of about $2,000 or more. End pages, by the way, are the pages at the front and back of a book that connect the binding to the pages, so like the cover, the hardcover of the book, to the rest of the book. I'm planning on publishing an episode about weird book terminology at a later date, so stay tuned for that, and please ask me all of the questions about weird book terminology that you can find on Twitter. I will answer them all. Okay, time to get into the nitty-gritty. The term first edition is often discussed in tandem with limited editions and rare printings. So a limited edition, to differentiate, is published separately from a first edition, but a limited edition almost always has a specific first edition as well. These types are called trade editions and come with added perks like perhaps a special cover or dust jacket. Limited editions are, unlike first editions, often signed and also numbered, so there's a specific number to each book in the series, and they'll come out with between 300 and 1,000 copies on average. Going back to my McCarthy discussion, for example, a deluxe limited edition of No Country for Old Men, not signed by the way, can go up to about $4,500 because less than 100 copies of that were made. This is all and well, but DH&I is about the relevancy of literature, yes, so what makes this episode relevant? Obviously, every year new books are written, and while it's almost impossible to tell which books are going to be famous or valuable one day, just pre-ordering a first edition of that 2018 book for $20 or less is a great start for a future book collection that's actually worth something. I like to exemplify that I practice what I preach, so in 2018, for example, I bought signed first editions of Bridge of Clay by Marcus Zusak, An Absolutely Remarkable Thing by Hank Green, and Calypso by David Sedaris, as well as a few others. Those are probably still on sale. You could probably still find signed copies of those for about $20, so might want to get on that. After all, you never know which book is going to be the next Twilight, and to exemplify this, a signed copy of the Twilight First Edition, by the way, goes for about $700, And if you have the whole book series with all signed first editions, that's going to go for four figures on average. The listing I was looking at actually said $4,000. And even if there's no guarantee that the book has future worth, it's a really cool and personal book to have in your collection or to give as a gift, just to know that some of your favorite authors have held at least part of the same book that you have. There are tons of other factors that play into this discussion, and I encourage you to visit the links below in search of other questions that you might be curious about. You can also, as always, find me on my blog or on Twitter with those questions so that I can research them and answer them in a future episode. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from me, there's an episode of DH&I for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our back catalog episodes, which should be available on whatever podcasting app you're listening on. If you need some guidance, try episode 4 about The Great Gatsby. This interview took me to Houston, Texas, and I quite enjoyed my time there. 2019 is the year of Didion, so if you'd like to follow along in my quest to read Joan Didion's collective works or learn more about the movement to bring lit back to people, everything can be found at didionandhawthorne.blueberry.net. And remember that blueberry is spelled B-L-U-B-R-R-Y. Now you can also follow the show on Twitter with @DidionIn, 2 N's total. I'll be posting about new lit releases, reading lists, and of course new projects and episodes relating to DH&I. Also stay tuned for the next episode. In 5 days' time, we will be talking about none other than Wuthering Heights, and I hope you guys will look forward to that. Still there? One more thing then. Remember that leaving a comment or review on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or any other Guilty Pleasure podcast platform helps leverage the show so that other literature enthusiasts can find the community. In other words, it helps a ton. Auf Wiederhören!